Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening, it's me, Nick Evets, 2 Echo Zero Lima, Uniform November, KC2VWR. Now, I'm going to quickly jump in and say this. If you're listening to the repeats, go to the AFM website, look on the announcements page, because all the links from tonight will be there waiting for you.
But in the meantime, of course, to us, we are broadcasting live at 9:02 in the evening.
He's alive!
Eastern Standard Time for North America on March the 10th, 2017. So that would put us Universal Time, 2:02 in the morning, March the 11th, Saturday morning, 2017. And, of course, during our live portion, we always invite you to come on over to our astronomy.fm chat room, which you can go to the homepage and, you know, find out where that is. Or just go to, just type in astronomy.fm/chat, and it'll get you, either way, it'll get you to the login, type in a name, and you'll be in our chat. We'll post some links to articles that we're talking about, so you can, you know, do some further reading. You can even ask us questions if you like, or you can ask other people in chat room questions too. So feel free to come in, and you can just come in and just read, and don't even have to say anything if you want to. That's fine too. So I want to say hi to everybody that's in chat right now. Of course, it's me and Nick, and then we've got Aquafew, Starstorm, Glenn, Crowtown Skies, Van Kirkpuk, and Don Seattle. So glad to have you in here so far, everybody. And, and I hope I pronounced your name properly.
There's been a big announcement. Well, this is news broken by the Planetary Society. Let's get the more volatile bits of the news out of the way first, shall we, Marty?
Oh, sure, but we won't be volatile about it.
Yeah, we can settle down and have a bit of fun. Okay, so as of the House has passed the NASA Transition Authorization Act of 2017 by voice vote this evening, clearing the measure for the president. The bill sets policy for NASA and recommends funding for fiscal year 2017, but, as usual, doesn't actually provide any money. This is Bill S-422. It passed the Senate by unanimous consent on February 17th, and it passed the House today by voice vote. Okay, so the House delayed the bill by about a week. No explanation was offered. Not surprising. So, human spaceflight is to be a major focus of the bill, although it also addresses NASA's space science, space technology, and aeronautics program. Guess what? No big surprise. It's silent on the Earth sciences, a topic of partisan discord. Okay, most Republicans feel that NASA should shift onto space administration whilst other agencies should conduct space science research. Guess what? I'm sure ESA will be very keen to hear that. They're probably going to have a bit of fun. But they've got plenty of missions which shadow the NASA ones. So, Nick from New York or London. Actually, north of London, a nice sleepy little place called Bedford, in the Shires, as they say. And thank you, Starstorm, for letting me know that question was being asked in chat. So, what have they said? In 146 pages, it's going to say it indemnifies launch and reentry service providers from third-party claims with conditions. So, for launches that are usually unusually hazardous or nuclear in nature. It requires NASA to submit a human exploration roadmap to expand human presence beyond low Earth orbit to the surface of Mars and beyond in a stepping stone manner, and requires a study on human mission to Mars to be launched in 2033. Doesn't say if it's going to be an orbital or a lander mission. No big surprise.
What I heard was it could be either, basically.
Yeah, so they haven't decided what they want yet, basically. They're going to keep everybody up in the air and guessing. Okay, so what else? NASA has to submit a report on how Orion spacecraft can be used to fulfill a provision in the 2010 Authorization Act to serve as a backup to commercial crew to take crews to and from the ISS, including on launch vehicles other than the Space Launch System. Support for SLS on Orion. Congress is not happy about the cost of the asteroid redirect robotic mission. They want to know, is it worth the benefits, and ask for analysis or alternatives to demonstrate technologies and capabilities needed for human exploration of Mars. I guess we're going to go back to Bruce Willis saving the world on that one, on the asteroid. Okay. It allows NASA to provide health care to former astronauts and government payload specialists for conditions resulting from their space flights. That is a good thing. Reaffirms congressional intent that NASA have a balanced and adequately funded science portfolio, including small, medium, and large space missions, suborbital missions, research and analysis grants, and technology development, with science priorities guided by the decadal surveys introduced by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Specific support for Mars 2020 rover, for the mission to Jupiter's moon Europa, the James Webb Telescope, and the Wide Field Infrared Space Telescope. And interestingly, prohibits NASA from cancelling the airborne Sophia Infrared Telescope. They've added a 10th item to the list of objectives to NASA's Organic Act, the search for life's origins, evolution, distribution, and future in the universe. Requires reports from the NASA admin on public-private partnerships to study astrobiology and near-Earth objects. My gosh, these politicians are winded, long-winded. Okay, now, just scrolling down a bit further. Oh, we're getting near the bottom. Allows NASA to conduct senior reviews of its science missions on a triennial rather than biennial basis. Expresses support for a robust aeronautics program, and establishes policy that NASA develop technologies to support NASA's core missions. Well, I think overall, there's some very good news in there. It is really sad that they're dumping the Earth science, considering NASA and ESA work together, along with the Russians in some areas, to study our own home world and give us eyes in the sky on storms and stuff. Hang on, I'm getting prodded a second. Hang on.
You want to bet half of them fall asleep during those dreams.
I think you all heard that comment. About half of them falling asleep during the reading of this bill. However, having said that, bonus Europa, bonus James Webb, a Wide Field Infrared Space Telescope, definitely a plus, and Sophia. Yes, it's an aging aircraft, and it's a little bit a little bit obsolete. But you know what? They do cutting work research. So, yes, I'm gonna like that. There's some other good stuff in there. So I think we can hope for at least leaving low Earth orbit within 2 years. Hopefully, going back to the moon. And definitely getting to Mars, I hope, by 2033. Because I want to see the first human on Mars. Yeah, long-winded paperless shufflers, and that's how they justify their jobs. But having said that, I think if we're going to get things done, we need to have a new generation literally step up to the plate and do these jobs themselves. People who want to go to Mars, want to go to Jupiter. So, I'm giving it a thumbs up cautiously.
You might want a new generation to go boldly, but they also tend to go blindly. I want an old generation, the ones with experience, to make those decisions. I find that when bureaucrats set goals, they do so without actually having experience on how long it takes to do something. So just so they, just because they want, you know, us to go to Mars in 10, 15 years doesn't mean it's actually possible. It doesn't mean they're funding it. This is like today's wish, but doesn't mean it's like next year's, you know, rule, which they tend to change almost, well, obviously like every, you know, 4 years or so, they change your priorities. So who can possibly work on a project that when, you know, the administration is changing every 4 years with a different agenda? So you can't force people to have experience, which is what this stuff takes. So the first space missions to the moon really started in the 40s.
Yeah.
With people just doing the very basic experiments, and then they grew 20, 25 years worth of experience until they were able to, you know, be able to do that. Well, you can't throw money and come up with experience.
This is true, and I'll be perfectly honest. I would like to see one of the more seasoned lunar landing astronauts, perhaps in charge of NASA, and the government saying, okay, instead of changing the administration at NASA every 4 years, we're going to give you 8 years, or maybe even 10.
An astronaut doesn't mean he's an engineer on rocket propulsion systems.
Well, the old other systems were, to some degree.
To some degree, but they were not the rocket builders.
But I know, but I tend to think that they still have the vision of the likes of Harrison Smith.
Well, there's the vision, but there's that what's more needed is the experience. And I find that people like in management say, you need to do this, not realizing how long it's going to take, if it's even possible. There's still the issues. Okay, now the rockets are getting better. They're building. They're getting bigger and bigger rockets. But there's still other issues of a long-term mission to Mars, like just the radiation issue. Now, just because you want to fly through radiation 15 years doesn't mean we actually can solve that problem. And it's not a matter of money.
It's a matter of engineering.
A matter of engineering. If it's a matter of engineering, yeah. So doesn't mean it's actually going to be possible to do that in 15 years. So it shouldn't be bureaucrats making that decision. Now, if they want to keep the funding up, that's good. But you can't buy time. You can buy you can buy parts.
Yeah.
You can, but you can't buy time. So if it's going to take more than 15 years to solve that issue, it doesn't matter what your demands are. They won't happen. No. Are they going to support this properly, or are they going to say, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to cut out these things because we're not experienced, so we don't think you need these sections of your division, and you get along with what you have with less, you know, material elsewhere, which they don't realize is really all part of the whole project. So basically, what they want is like a caviar with a dollar menu budget. It just doesn't happen.
Well, I think the thing is, though, in the old days, and I think you'll agree with this, Marty, particularly in the days of Gemini and Apollo, the astronauts were actually part of the engineering solution. They spent time at the facilities that were building the rockets for them, that were building the capsules, and all the equipment they had a hand in. Now, I know for a fact that certain contractors and certain astronauts had personality issues and conflicts. But it was a way that the program actually progressed. James Webb had to the end of the decade to put a man on the moon. So they hadn't even put a man in orbit yet. And the first thing they had to do was put a man in orbit. But you know what? It can be done if the desire, if the sense of urgency, if the sense of urgency is there, we can get our space program back on track. The biggest mistake that was made, and this was a political mistake, at the end of the day, it was politics. We lost two or three Apollo missions right at the end. Now, they metamorphed into the Apollo-Soyuz link-up, which was good because it allowed us to test Russian and American technology together. And then we had Skylab. Now, had we gone on and finished the complete run of Apollo missions and still having the technology to use, perhaps we wouldn't be behind schedule with Mars.
But possibly the radiation problem might still not have been solved by now, or even that's 15 true. Years from now.
That's true. I agree, Marty. But the thing is, we would have made the initial stepping stones to being in a situation where we would have at least a technology we knew could do a long-term mission.
Yes.
Away from
long-distance mission.
Yeah.
See that.
The actual technology to do it would be there. Yes, we are still going to have to solve it. We've got to figure out a way to build something into a spacecraft that will help prevent, that won't attract the radiation. We know that polyethylene is a very good way of doing this, and water is a very good way of blocking it. But this is going to be adding a heck of a lot of mass mm-hmm. to the spacecraft. So, if we hadn't had the dilly-dallying from about the 70s onwards, and really saddling NASA with the space shuttle, it was great to have a reusable spacecraft. It's reusable to a point.
Exactly.
It still takes several months to regenerate before it can be launched again. Now we are hoping with Orion, we're going to have a faster turnaround. We're going to leave part of the spacecraft parked in orbit, awaiting the next capsule to be launched. So it will mate up with the command module that's already up there and that's already functioning, and it will go and do its work. That's brilliant. But we should have had it 10 years ago. We should have had it 15 years ago. And we didn't, because NASA isn't allowed to have the one thing it really needs, which is a publicity machine like the US Army has. NASA cannot go on TV and publicize itself. It cannot put adverts out like the US Army or the other armed forces do. It's prohibited. And I think that has been a major stumbling block for a space program, because it can't reach the hearts and minds of the people like other government agencies can do on TV.
Well, we'll see what happens. Like I said, 4 years from now,
yeah,
be a complete turnaround, and that really takes away from engineers' ability to basically focus on one project when everything gets yanked out from under your feet. You take a tumble and stand up and say, "All right, now what am I supposed to work on?" It's like, we'll see what happens. But
You know what's going to happen in the end, don't you?
Well, who knows? No, we don't know what's going to happen in the end. That's part of the problem.
Yeah. Okay. This is what happens in the job world. If somebody shuts you down, you go work for somebody else, namely the competition.
ESA, maybe. China.
Maybe not so much China, because I don't think China's going to want Westerners working on their space program and writing home about what they can do and can't do. However, people like ESA and maybe Roscoff to a greater degree, they would snap up those engineers that had been working on SLS, Orion, etc., and put them to work. Because you know what? ESA has a different idea. Every project is group funded by all the governments. You put in as much as you want to a project. That project then employs X number of your nationals. That's one of the ways it works. And if you don't have anybody that wants to work on it, that's fine. But you know what? At the end of the day, the politicians leave ESA alone. They just want a report on a regular basis on the progress of the technology and of everything else. Keep us informed how it's going on. And that is why ESA has developed systems like Vega. It is continuing to develop Ariane. Now, there is perhaps a possibility Ariane, in its next evolution, will be able to carry Orion. And that would be totally and utterly awesome. The ESA has access to the Soviet technology already. They have Soyuz. They have their own Soyuz launch facility. They have their own capsules. They have everything on hand at Kourou. They can launch, and eventually they're going to get to the point where they're going to be refurbishing equipment and reusing it. They are gonna say, why are we constantly buying all the time? Let's look at what we can do. Oh yeah, so the Soyuz capsule we launched 6 months ago is back. We'll refurbish it, process it, put it on the next rocket. And that is the, I think honestly, ESA will get a manned rocket, and they will have their own commercial crew system running. And if we're not careful, we're going to get left behind, because everybody will be running to ESA to do things, because ESA isn't worried about political will, because most of the time the governments keep well out of it. They just agree to fund projects to X level, and that's the end of it. There is no political control of ESA. It is complete because of the way it's put together. One man makes the decisions, like at NASA, but he doesn't have to worry about being kicked out in 4 years' time. And I think that's something that we have to address with NASA. We have to give the head of NASA a fair crack of the whip. Now, if he truly and monumentally screws up, by all means, kick him out. That's what happens. It happens in the corporate world. But keep NASA on an even keel, give them continuity, and give them something approaching a sensible budget for what you want them to do. I think it works out that the NASA budget is about $3 per person, per citizen in the US. That is one hell of a low budget, really, per person on the tax base.
Well, we'll see. I've learned not to do predictions on future space missions in any way. They almost never come true. So things constantly change. So it's like, it's kind of pointless to say this is going to happen and this is going to happen. It's just pointless to do that. All right, let's move on. Anybody seen Pan lately?
Oh, you mean that lovely little moon of Jupiter that looks like something like a piece of ravioli?
Saturn.
Sorry, Jupiter. Yes, Saturn. Ah.
Yes.
Sorry.
So you can go to the NASA webpage, look up Cassini mission, and then you'll see the latest picture of the moon called Pan. Pretty small moon, only about 20 miles, I would not say diameter, but across. Very unusual looking moon. People describe it as a ravioli, and kind of like Saturn, if you want to call it. It sort of has a band around it. Well, I don't know. It must be about at least a mile wide band, half a mile thick, something like that is what it looks like. It's really unusual. So I hope you get a chance to look at it. Supposition on how that occurred would be pretty interesting too. See what else they'll be able to find. If it was formed larger, got chipped away, broke away, or it was part of a collision. Who knows? But this is really one of the weirdest moons or asteroid I have ever seen, and nobody could even imagine this shape would even be possible to occur.
Well, they used to say that about Phobos, didn't they?
Phobos? What was Phobos?
In Mars?
Yeah, it was lumpy, I think.
Lumpy, potato-y.
Mm-hmm. That's not too unusual. Like, a lot of the asteroids
rotten are at the core.
Kind of like potato-y and clumps of clusters and stuff like
that. You know what? Looking at the picture in the New York Times, it looks like a pierogi.
Yeah, I thought so too when I first saw it. I was like, what is this thing? It's like, this can't be real. And I had to confirm what it really was. Yeah, it looks like a pierogi. Aqua says it looks like a flying saucer. Does look like a flying saucer.
Quick, don't tell everybody. The aliens will be after us.
Exactly. Yeah, it'd be interesting to – I know this UFO radio show I listen to for fun once in a while. It'd be interesting to see what they say about this one. Like, oh, my, let's see what happens.
Excuse me.
I put in a link into the NASA website called Journey to Mars. So basically a big focus on everything Mars. So check that out. Some interesting clouds flying by, dust clouds, I think, on Mars. With some, you can see the dust actually rippling across the surface. So that's pretty interesting. So lots of new Mars stuff. Evidence of daily changes in some of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what that's from?
Now, an old friend of ours from recent news is back in the news, literally.
Get up.
Okay. If I say TRAPPIST-1,
Yes.
We remember the seven planets, or seven dwarves, as some people were saying. Now, this could actually be quite a deadly place.
It's
an ultra cool M dwarf star, seven potential rocky exoplanets. Now, there's a problem. They're thinking actually that it's putting out enough high energy radiation to tear away the inner planet's atmospheres in a few billion years. Now, they've used the Hubble Space Telescope to study the star's ultraviolet. Specifically, they've looked at the Lehmann alpha emission, which is a particular wavelength emitted by hydrogen atoms, and it comes from the star's chromosphere, which is the layer between the stellar surface, the photosphere, and the intensely hot ionized wispy corona. They found that TRAPPIST-1 emits more than half as much Lehmann alpha radiation as other cool exoplanet hosting M dwarfs, including Proxima Centauri, which spews for six times more ultraviolet than TRAPPIST-1 does. Well, that's expected since TRAPPIST-1 is also cooler than the other M dwarfs. However, they also found that it emits as much in X-rays as Proxima Centauri. Those X-rays are coming from the star's coronas. The ratio of X-rays to ultraviolet is interesting for a couple of reasons. First, X-ray and ultraviolet output decreases with time for these stars, but X-rays drop off much faster. The fact that TRAPPIST-1 emits roughly a third as much energy in Lehmann alpha as it does in X-ray suggests that the star is relatively young. Now, this was posted in the team's March 2017 Astronomy and Astrophysics article. Now, what relatively young means is an open question. They know that the star is roughly 500 million years old because it's settled into being an adult star. Beyond that is anyone's guess. So Jeffrey Linsky, University of Colorado Boulder, who also has worked on extensively on M dwarfs and trends in alpha, in Lehmann alpha and X-ray emission for different types of stars, says TRAPPIST-1 seems to be both old and young. Well, stars are born spinning quickly and they slow as they age. TRAPPIST-1 whips around every 1.5 days, which at face value could point to it being very young, he says. Mm-hmm. But they don't know how fast these ultra-cool dwarfs spin down. Furthermore, the star's fast motion through space, it would usually indicate it's a member of the old stellar population that comprises the galaxy halo. But no one knows if that's a fluke or not. Anyway, the article's there. Have a good read and enjoy, because you know what? This is a unfolding story. I think we're going to be hearing more about TRAPPIST-1 in the future, relatively near future as well. So it could be that, yes, it is a good opportunity for possibly eventually, I said the word eventually, having life. Or then again, maybe not, if the inner planets are going to be stripped of their atmospheres fairly quickly. So let's sit and wait and see. If you can get hold of, go look at the article and see what you think. I think it's definitely well worth a read.
Yeah, the cooler and smaller the star is, the longer it lasts in that configuration. So once it forms, it stays that way for a long, long time because doesn't fuse hydrogen very quickly. In fact, it does very, very slowly. So, this thing could be older than the sun.
Yeah.
And it's obviously going to last in this configuration longer than the sun. So the sun lasts about 10 billion years. This could be one of those 100 billion year stars. So it could have formed, very, very early almost 13 billion years ago. And it could, still retain the shape. Yeah, I didn't know it was spinning that fast. That's pretty unusual for something that small to be spinning that fast. Usually it's the bigger stuff that spins faster because it gets more stuff, dumped on it, and it just increases its rotation. But is it slowing down, or the planet slowing down? Is there some tidal effects with those planets being close to it? Hard to say. So definitely looking forward to more information on the system. And these planets pass in front of that star, so one of the things they will be checking will be for atmospheres of the planets. Mm-hmm. Basically analyzing the light of the star as a planet goes across and see if it changes. And the better equipment out there will give us better analysis.
Absolutely. And of course, with good luck, and maybe Orion getting on back on schedule or getting ahead of schedule, who knows? Maybe we'll get lucky enough, and there may be another repair mission to Hubble. Mm-hmm. Maybe not just simply a repair mission, but a major upgrade. It is being talked about, but obviously there's nothing currently on the books. But I think until we actually get Orion fully fledged, that's not going to happen. However, I do think that Hubble has got quite a long life left in it, and I think for the foreseeable future, even with the launch of the James Webb,
and the images are still beautiful from Hubble.
Yep, and as is pointed out by Starstorm, the images are still beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think it has got a long life. Even with the new infrared telescopes that are being put into space coming on stream, Hubble fulfills a very unique niche in that it can look in ultraviolet, some infrared, and it can do visible light. So it, as a research tool, it certainly deserves to be kept in commission for as long as possible. And if that means being able to service and upgrade the instruments, I'm all for it. That's also going to be very good practice for Mars, because this is the type of thing you're going to have to be able to do en route to Mars, is to repair and fix issues with your spacecraft. And the best way to practice that, okay, on Earth, it's in a tank full of water to simulate near weightlessness, the moon, and of course, actually doing it in space on an object that's floating nearby. And I do honestly believe servicing the Hubble would be in our best interests.
So far, it looks like I'd say yes. It looks like keeping the Hubble running looking like it's staying to be a good telescope. So I agree. If it's viable and practical, yeah, just definitely keep it
Marty, running. It's the bottom of the hour. Know.
We are at the bottom of the hour. That means we are halfway through our program tonight. You are listening to the Event Horizon here on astronomy.fm. It is another Friday evening. This one happens to be March the 10th, 2017, about 9:32 for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So universal time, that would be 2:32 on Saturday, March the 11th, 2017. So we still have another half hour or so of live programming. And, of course, invite you to come on over to our astronomy.fm chat room. Either go to the homepage or just type in astronomy.fm/chat. Now, either way, it'll get you to the login. And come on over. We're putting links to the articles that we talk about so you can do further reading. You can ask us questions. You can ask other people in chat questions. If you have any astronomy questions, we'll try to answer them for you as best we can. So let's say hi to everybody in chat room so far. We got you and me, of course. We got Aqua for You, Starstorm, Glenn, Crowtown Skies, and Van Kirkprints. Welcome. I'm glad to have you here in our chat room. Let's see. Quick survey. Does everyone think we need to go to Mars? Mostly people do, I'd say. I'd say yes. What do you say, Nick?
I agree. Mars would be a very good place to go to. And it gives us experience in actually going to the outer solar system.
Now, I do know people that are strict robotic probe people only. They would rather have robotic probes do all of it. Well, that's their opinion, but I don't think so.
I disagree. Robotic probes are brilliant. However, remote control from Earth, particularly on Mars, is that there is a time lag, and the Mark 1 eyeball sees things that rovers miss. Of course, my favorite point for this, of course, is the orange soil found by the Apollo astronauts on the moon. That would have quite possibly have been totally and utterly missed by a robot probe.
With the technology, then, yes. But what if you get into artificial intelligence that could do all of that stuff? No, that could be a game changer right there.
Yeah, you got to have an AI that is not going to go totally nuts.
Well,
because you told it to keep parts of the mission secret.
Well, there's all that part of that. Well, astronauts on a long trip could go totally nuts too.
Oh yeah, but you know what? It's not going to. I don't think when we start exploring the outer solar system as manned missions, it's going to be a cramped, small spacecraft. Yes, Starstorm, we could repair our lost rovers, upgrade them, and have them doing even more science. That would be a great idea. Why not?
And helping us build
a Mars colony.
All right, how about this? Yes, colonies on Mars, Mars tourism. Would you go for that?
I would.
I would too.
I would actually like to go to Jupiter and visit the Jovian system, and maybe even as far as Saturn.
Well, obviously, Saturn would be a much nicer place to look at.
Yeah, to look down on the rings.
Mm-hmm.
From the Saturnian North
Right.
Pole.
How about this colonizing the Moon?
Go for it. You know what? The best place to test your technology for Mars is the Moon. It's close. It means if something does go wrong, we can get the astronauts and engineering teams back.
Now, I don't think colonizing the Moon would be that great of an idea. I could see like Antarctic research type stations on the Moon. You have plenty of them, but I don't see people purposely really wanting to live there very long.
Well, the thing is, if you're going to have a colony on the Moon, then you're probably going to have it for scientific research reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not thinking perhaps of everybody moving to the Moon and enjoying the low gravity for fun and games. I'm more thinking of good places for telescopes, for radio telescopes. You don't have an atmosphere per se to worry about. There is a very thin exosphere, as I remember, for the Moon, and it is very thin.
Yes.
And, of course, it is a perfect place to conduct scientific research. And the best type of research you can obviously conduct there is on rocket engines, on spacecraft drives, because you haven't got to worry about a population center being accidentally, whoops, we nuked it. Sorry,
well,
chaps.
Well, that's still possible. You could wipe out your entire moon base there, research
you
station.
You could do that, yes, but having the test facilities for any future space drives on the Moon would give you a nice big degree of safety. You don't have to have them in the same crater or area as your moon base. You can just drive out in your pressurized moon buggy to your test site and work there.
Now for a pretty much permanent research station where you would have pretty much permanent residents, and pretty much permanent residents would like more than just researchers there. I'm sure they would like families there. So you'd have to kind of expand it almost into a colony. You know, if you got families, you're going to need schools, you're going to need types of entertainment for people that are there for their family, but not necessarily there for research itself.
Why not have husband and wife science teams?
One thing you will never have on the Moon is a really good restaurant.
This is true. It'll be pre-packed food. But
No. There's just no atmosphere.
What's wrong with the restaurant being inside the moon base? Anyway.
No. You don't get what it takes for a really good restaurant. Maybe now, some people get it.
Starstorm has suggested testing the gases on Jupiter. You could do some very interesting chemistry out there. You could probably do hands-on chemistry about the Jovian and Saturnian atmosphere.
Kind of hard to test how things rust out outside, though.
Yeah. I'm just receiving a message that we've actually made our radio director laugh.
he got the joke.
He got the joke. But seriously, why not go? Why don't we go to Saturn and Jupiter and do our experiments and our research on the spot? Okay, we can't stay within the radiation belt of Jupiter. We can have a base outside it. We could then use it to really get some hands-on science on the whole Jovian system. We could actually perhaps put a manned lander on Europa. Hopefully we won't find an obelisk in the way.
I don't know if that would be that necessary for such a hostile environment, though. So I think excessively hostile like that, maybe robotic probes would be much better. Because all that radiation, going down into the ice of Europa would be extremely dangerous to impossible for people. Yeah, ice eruptions and things like that, water eruptions occurring. You can blow your whole base up into have it come crashing down. So probably not a good idea for the outer gas planets to do anything permanent. Mm. Now, if there was something...
Mining stations.
I should say economical mining. I could see something like that. Well, we've seen some sci-fi movies about that before.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Outland springs to mind.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing, even Starstorm suggested getting ice cores samples from Europa. That would be...
what we've got here on Earth.
and compare them to what we get we got here on Earth. That's a brilliant idea.
Yep, but would not need people to do that. So that definitely could be robotic.
Let's give a little run. As you can hear, Starstorm is taking a part in the show this week, folks.
let's give a little rundown on what's up in the sky. How about that?
Okay.
I've got the U.S. Naval Observatory site homepage tonight. By the way, Regulus will be only about 0.8 of a degree north of the moon. There was an occultation, but I think you had to be like way far south in order to be able to see that. Full moon on Sunday. Jupiter on Tuesday will be 2 degrees south of the moon. Next Wednesday, Pallas in conjunction with that. Why do they even bother with those? Pallas in conjunction. So if an asteroid's too close to the sun, you can't see it. I don't know why they bother with that stuff. But that's about it for this week. So nothing really that special. We had some really bad windstorms going through here last Wednesday. Wiped out the power to my work. It's still out. I had some big projects on the observatory. We're going to bring in, I was hoping to get it on the radio too, we're going to bring in one of the technicians from the company that made our telescope called Planewave. I'm going to go through, check some equipment out, check lubrication, stuff like that, do some alignment. Then I was going to have somebody come in. We're going to do some astrophotography. I was hoping to get that tech on the air for an interview. Would have been really good timing. And 5 minutes before closing, the power crashed, and it's still been out. And we had 2 days of really clear skies. I can't even go in there to do any, side work.
You know what you're missing tonight, don't you, Marty?
Let's see, what am I missing tonight?
Second brightest asteroid occultation predicted this year for North America.
Really?
A 6.3 magnitude star in Leo's snout, just in front of the sickle, should snap out of sight for up to 3 seconds for observers along a narrow track running from the Georgia coast to just north of San Francisco. The culprit is the 15th magnitude asteroid 1343 Nicole. It's only about 26 kilometers, 16 miles wide. Now, at the moment, Leo will be very high in the southwest or south at the time. So this is basically you've got to get out there now to watch it. So,
Leo's in the southeast right now. So what time is it going to happen?
It's later tonight.
Later tonight? Okay. So, it looks like in a couple more hours, Leo will be somewhere around the meridian. So I don't know what time it's going to occur. Be interesting. I have tried watching some of these. And I can't remember if I've actually seen an asteroid occultation of a star or not. They're actually pretty cool. What you can actually determine the size of the asteroid by doing this. If you get enough people from your astronomy club, and if you happen to be approximately on the shadow track of it, what you want to do is spread your observers out, let's say about every mile, if you can, north and south, as many as you can. Have them do very accurate timings of the star blinking out. And some people will be able to see it blink out and some that won't. So that the distance that you are separated will be able to basically determine how big the asteroid itself is. So if you have like 20 observers and they're basically every mile apart, and let's say the northernmost ones don't see it blink out. The southernmost ones don't see it blink out, but the ones in between see it blink out. That means that's how big the asteroid actually is. Now, with accurate timings, as far as on and off the light, you can actually determine the shape of the asteroid. So you can find out if it's rare, if it's round, if it's oblong in which direction. You can actually make a map of the asteroid by doing observations like this. But you have to have a bunch of people. And there are organizations that basically do this. So if you're just by yourself, if you accurately pinpoint your location on the Earth and then very accurately time your observation of when you see it on and when you see it off, you can actually contribute your data and they will actually determine the shape and size of the asteroid. It's actually a pretty cool experiment.
The time is at 6:31 Universal Time on the 11th of March. So
0630?
0631.
1 o'clock in the morning, I think, for us.
About 1 o'clock in the morning, yes.
Oh, that's not too bad.
And don't forget, folks, Sunday morning, the clocks go forward.
Oh, do they? Yeah, yes. Okay.
I've been getting emails about it all week at work,
reminding
me to put my clocks forward at 2 a.m. Sunday morning.
Oh, I almost forgot. That means I would have gone into work, what, an hour earlier, an hour later. One would be to my advantage. One's not. Well, oh, well. Yeah, if you get a chance to, if you happen to be anywhere near the track, even if you don't want to do, you know, real timings of it, go out and have a look at it. It's actually pretty cool to see a star just blink out for a few seconds and then blink back on. And something similar to that, last week we had the moon go in front of Aldebaran in Taurus. And right along the whole northern half of North America, there was a line where if you were on that line, you would actually see the star appear and disappear in the valleys and mountains of the moon. And that's pretty cool, too. People have actually done that same type of thing. If you time it exactly and compare the observations with your location, they were actually able to determine the heights of the mountains on the moon by an occultation like that.
Now, there's an organization called IOTA, which provides, not only do they provide you with charts, they provide you with timing equipment. Now, I got an email on that. I was talking to my good friend Damien Alice of the Central New York Observers Group, and he's put me in touch with the guy who provided a lot of the stuff for the Aldebaran occultation. So I'm going to quickly just pull that up. It's going to take me a few seconds because I've got to find the linked email again.
Do you recall how bright the star is that's going to be occulted? You said the asteroid's 15, so you don't have to see the asteroid because being 15, it's too dark to see visually, but that's okay.
6.3 magnitude.
Oh, that's an easy one. Now, that's a barely naked eye, but definitely a binocular type of event. So easy to see this star with a pair of binoculars. Easier if you have a binoculars mounted on a tripod, so it'll hold steady right there. And because even if you don't want to shake the binoculars and lose the view for even a few seconds, because that might be when the event happens. So that's an actually pretty easy one. We have the alignment for that.
As I say, it's not very much information there. It's in the actual this week's Sky at a Glance from Sky and Telescope, March 10, 2018.
Okay, looks like it's going to go through somewhere around the middle of the west coast of the U.S.
From Georgia, the Georgia coast, just north of San Francisco.
Okay, and so right across the southern states of the U.S.
Yeah. Oh. So if you've got a chance, get out there and have a look for it. It's going to be a unique event.
Definitely a fun one.
Okay, now I did put a link in earlier, and I forgot all about it. There's a new take on the Audible Meteor Mystery.
Okay.
Now, the recent study suggests a plausible mechanism to explain why observers sometimes hear super bright meteors at the same time they see them.
Which should be impossible.
Yeah. Now, the astronomical literature is dotted with reports of observers hearing bright meteors that seem to hiss, pop, or ping. Now, a recent survey in Nature, the scientific reports out of the Sampdoria National Laboratory suggests a possible cause. Most of the meteors you see at night are tiny dust grains burning up as they streak through the Earth's atmosphere at up to 40 miles an hour, 70 kilometers per second.
40,000 miles an hour. I thought you said 40.
It's 43
miles.
Up to 43 miles per second.
Oh, per second. Okay, that works.
Yeah. Now, once in a great while, something really big, say golf ball size, comes in burning up as a brilliant fireball display.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a fireball is a meteor that's brighter than -4 magnitude, as bright as Venus. And a bolide is a fireball with a bright terminal flash at the end of its trail. Sometimes observers report hearing a distinct hiss or crackle accompanying many bright fireballs, simultaneously with the bright flash. Now, but the trouble with hearing concurrent sounds with meteors has always been the distance involved. Not only do meteors occur in the tenuous upper atmosphere, which is a poor propagator of sound, they're also very distant, occurring in the mesosphere about 47 to 62 miles up. Mm-hmm. Sound at sea level travels at 767 miles per hour. Think of lightning on a summer's day and how you always see the flash several seconds before the booming thunder arrives. And yet reports of audible meteors persist. This study proposes that the strong millisecond-long flashes recorded in bright fireballs are intense enough to induce radiative heating in dielectric materials such as dry leaves, clothing, or even hair in the vicinity of the observer via what is called the photoacoustic effect. The irradiated surfaces heat the air next to them, producing tiny pressure oscillations. In other words, sound.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all sound is. It's a pressure oscillation. Now, the studies shows that a bolide around minus 12 in magnitude, about half as bright as the full moon, will induce an audible sound in the dielectric material of about 25 decibels, loud enough to be heard. For context, a whisper is 10 to 20 decibels on the lower threshold, which is barely audible. The study even suggests that frizzy hair might be an even more effective transducer of the effect. And it seems significant that people with frizzy hair are reported to more likely have heard the concurrent sound for meteors. So intuitively, fuzzy hair should be a good transducer for two reasons. The hair near the ears will create localized sound pressure, so it's likely to be heard. And also, hair has a large surface-to-volume ratio, which maximizes sound. I think this is something else we're going to perhaps going to see and maybe hear more of.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Basically, go on, Marty.
I've always kind of like doubted that. It's just impossible to hear the sound at the same time as you're seeing the meteor, because 5 seconds per mile, so times this, so that's 5 minutes for something 60 miles up. Good example of this, really good example, is look at the Chelyabinsk event. Yeah. So you see the flash, and it's several minutes before the boom occurs, and that's the most accurate way of hearing a meteor, because that was definitely loud enough to create a big boom.
Well, that created a sonic boom.
Yeah, but I
large enough and mean enough to do it, and probably that was exactly what the Tunguska airburster would create as well.
But the sonic boom is a good example of how long it takes that sound to travel through the atmosphere from really high up. That's what people were basically. They saw the flash, or they kind of saw the flash around them. Went out to look at the window for a few minutes, and then a few minutes later, that's when the glass broke in, because it took long for the sound to get to the people. It's definitely not instantaneous.
But the sound is actually happening, is being created closer to the ears.
Electrically, no.
Photoacoustically.
Yep. Photoacoustically. Okay, from the bright light affecting...
Yep. Affecting the hair. And so it sounds like this is going to be, again, another story to follow on and see exactly what happens. Again, it's something that is just happening. This is something that's being looked at right now. Will we hear more about it? I hope so. It's just one of those interesting things.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of solve that illusion there.
Oh, yeah. Now, March 14th, Tuesday, okay. Jupiter Spica and the waning gibbous moon form a triangle that's going to be rises in the east around 9 or 10 p.m. on that night. Algol is at its minimum brightness, magnitude 3.4 instead of its usual 2.1. For roughly 2 hours, centered on 9:24 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And, of course, on the 15th, the tiny black shadow of Jupiter's moon Europa crosses the planet's face on that night from 10:48 p.m. to 1:17 a.m. EDT, with Europa following itself behind from 11:55 p.m. to 12:16 a.m. Okay, if you're in the central time zone, subtract 1 hour from those times to get CDT, 2 hours to get MDT, and 3 to get PDT.
Oh, let's see. What was I going to mention? Oh, yeah. The planet Venus is still there, but guys, it's going really fast. It's going to start. It's getting closer to the sun. It's going to pass in front. Well, in the same declination as the sun fairly quickly. So we've only got a few more weeks of looking at Venus, so get those observations in now. I looked at it last week in the daytime. Still pretty nice, crescent shape, pretty easy to see. Jupiter, of course, rising, lots of observations for Jupiter. But Venus is definitely going away, so get your last shots of that. I also want to mention Vesta is in Gemini, the twins. So if you want to see that asteroid, still got plenty of time to see that one. Some observations out there. We're going from the gas nebula season to the galaxy season.
Yeah.
So all Orion, around that area, the Rosette Nebula, stuff like that. That's still around, but we're going towards the Leo-Virgo season, and that's the galaxy part of the sky.
And, of course, on the traditional divide between spring and winter skies is the dim constellation Cancer, which lies between Gemini to its west and Leo to its east. Dim it may be, but it does have something very unique. The Beehive Cluster, M44, in its middle. Now, it only shows very dimly to the naked eye, but you have little or no light pollution with binoculars. It's a snap even from fairly polluted areas. Look for it a little less than halfway from Pollux in Gemini to Regulus in Leo. And, of course, on Saturday, Jupiter's moon Io will be barely off Jupiter's western limb, disappearing into eclipse by Jupiter's shadow around 10:24 p.m. EDT. A small telescope will show it slowly fade away.
And again, go to Project Pluto if you want to know when those moons of Jupiter events are going to occur.
Yeah.
They list them all there. I always use that all the time. And now you're saying from winter to spring, but that's only for the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere obviously going from summer to fall. So we're coming up on equinox in just a couple of weeks, so we will get to that one when we get a little closer to that. Oh, by the way, I will not be here next Friday, by the way. So we'll see if Nick gets his usual co-host or John to come on in next Friday, but I'll be out of town next Friday.
One other thing, as we're entering the time of year where Orion declines to the southwest after dark, with his belt, now this is going to be interesting because the belt will be turning horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
But when does Orion's belt appear exactly horizontal? Well, that depends where you're located, east to west in your time zone and your latitude. Can you time the event? If you're near your time zone's standard longitude, expect it around 9:10 this evening on March the 16th, more or less.
All righty.
So there's plenty of things you can do with just the naked eye. You don't need a telescope. You could do this with binoculars, or you can just do it with the naked eye. So saying that, oh, I've got a setup kit to do this, don't worry about it. Go out there, take the family out, have a bit of fun, and then come back in once it's all over. Cup of hot chocolate and something a bit stiff to go with it as well, and you'll be right as rain in a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Good time for observing for both hemispheres because the weather is getting moderate. So we're losing here in the north, we're losing our cold winter weather, and in the south, they're losing their hot summer weather. So, and daytime, nighttime is kind of evening out too. So makes it a more pleasant time during the equinoxes to do some observing.
Yeah. Marty, can you pass me that tricorder, please? We've got to get things lashed down. In the last 2 minutes of the show, my friend.
Last 1 minute of our show. So this is the time where we say thanks to everybody that's been in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you being here. Thanks again. I won't see you next week, but Nick will probably. What was I going to say? Don't forget, we repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours, and we have more programming coming up, so keep listening in to more programs on astronomy.fm radio. Well, Nick, I think it's about
USS
that.
USS Miranda, 3 to beam up.
I think it's about
away that. Team ready to come home.
All right, what color shirt are you wearing today, Nick?
I'm actually in my proper Starfleet Sciences shirt.
I'm wearing like green, so that doesn't mean anything.
I just to prove it.
Night all.
Putting a link in the chat.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website, It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham, astronomy right between the eyes.